The Tribune has covered DCFS and child welfare repeatedly as an investigative project over the recent years. So we've always heard rumors that there were problems at residential treatment centers. And from time to time, I've written about problems like runaways from the center. But this was the first time we'd ever taken a serious, focused, concerted look at the issue.
And so how would teens end up in these places in the first place?
These are centers that are meant to provide treatment to young people who live there for usually spells of several months to sometimes several years. And the kids are referred to these centers by DCFS, which is the state child welfare agency. Some smaller numbers are also referred by schools, by the Department of Juvenile Justice, by the Department of Human Services, and in some cases by concerned guardians or parents.
And how many teens in all are placed there? What are the most current numbers?
Across Illinois, there are about 2,300 licensed beds in these facilities. There's about 50 facilities, roughly, that serve young people. And of those, on any given day, about 1,400 of those 2,300 are DCFS wards, and the rest are placed by other agencies or families. We looked at residential treatment centers across the state and ultimately across the country. What we did was we gathered police and state monitoring records on all of the biggest centers going from the southern tip of the state all the way up to the Wisconsin border.
So you looked at two residential centers in Chicago as well, and verified at least 14 youths who'd engaged in prostitution since 2011. Did you get the sense that that number could be higher?
Absolutely. The number we got is a very conservative number of kids involved in prostitution while they were living at the centers, as verified by government records. But we found dozens more in interviews with kids that we tried our best to corroborate with other interviews, but they weren't listed in government records. And these were kids, basically, Rachel, who were going out on short runs from the facility for sometimes just several hours or a night, engaging in prostitution, and then coming back to the facilities. We found that these kids who were experienced at prostitution would then induce others into the lifestyle or the business or the schemes by introducing them to pimps, by introducing them to street corners or internet escort services. Some facilities, two of them that you're referring to, we found that prostitution was an ongoing pattern at the facility.
And so one young woman you spoke with was named Mary Bohannon. Tell us a bit about her story, if you can.
Sure. Mary was a child adopted from the country of Lebanon, who was placed in a special education school when she was very young. And there she was sexually assaulted by an older peer and sort of began a period of deteriorating psychologically in many ways after that, running away and getting involved in sexual activity that's actually very predictable for kids who've been the victims of crimes. And we found she was sent to Rock River Academy, a residential treatment center in Rockford, in 2012. And while there, she would go on short runs and would be prostituted on the streets of Rockford and elsewhere in Illinois. The facility knew about this. She returned from one of these short episodes with a large bruise that she said had come from a pimp in Rockford. But we found that inside that facility, her behavior really received no meaningful counseling or therapy as a result. She was just placed back at the facility. Finally, at the age of 19, last year, she was picked up by police in a truck stop in Bloomington, where she had been prostituted by a pimp. We talked to that pimp. He's in prison now for that crime and others. And he very frankly talked about how he favored using young women from group homes and residential centers as prostitutes because they had no family, they had no supports, they had no one else, and they could very easily be manipulated. And that's how he described Mary also.
And so you also spoke with DCFS Director Bobby Gregg. What was maybe the most valuable insight you think you got out of her?
When we spoke to DCFS Director Bobby Gregg, what really surprised me was that she wasn't aware of the levels of violence and running away and the prostitution schemes that we found in government records. And I guess the insight, Rachel, for us was that these facilities are required under their contracts and by law to generate what are called unusual incident reports whenever a kid is placed in harm or hurt actually inside the facilities, including the fights that go on, the sexual assaults that go on, the prostitution that goes on. And indeed, these facilities were filing thousands of these unusual incident reports with DCFS, but the reports were not really being read and acted upon in any effective way. We found that DCFS was more than a year behind in gathering basic data about the runaways and about some of the incidents of harm, and didn't have an effective way of sorting through and acting on some of these really harrowing reports. They're the kind of reports that if you were a parent and you read about a place where you had a kid, you would be there banging on the door the next day demanding action. But that wasn't happening.
I'm Rachel Otwell. I'm joined by David Jackson. He's a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and he's been working on a series investigating residential treatment centers run by the state for young people. And so one of the things that stands out about the investigation that's maybe a little less quantifiable is the fact that a lot of these kids seem to just be lacking emotional support. An adult who has that sort of emotional connection that teens probably might not be seeking out, but that they need. These are treatment centers. What sense did you get of the actual treatment and that sort of emotional support that was actually being offered, or was it just completely lacking?
Well, there were some facilities that were said to and seemed to be doing a good job of that. But again, we really focused on the largest facilities where there was a lot of assaults and rape and running away and prostitution, and yet DCFS was still sending kids back. In those facilities, Rachel, what we found was that they were often extremely understaffed. The staff were the frontline workers who really deal with these kids day in and day out, often were paid just barely above minimum wage. And they complained constantly about the violence and their own safety. They told us, well, they didn't really have time to do kind of effective therapy or to bond with these kids or to get to know them. They were basically just trying to manage the violence and the chaos that happens in these places. We talked to a lot of young people who'd been through these facilities, including several who were runaways who we tracked down and found on the streets. They told us one after the other that really they found the facilities to be very frightening. There was a sort of an initiation of fighting that often happened. You get jumped. Not long after being in these places, they talked about coerced sex, an almost sort of prison-like atmosphere where residents preyed on other residents with little consequence. They told us again and again that in many cases, they felt like they went in needing help, but they came out much worse than they went in. They came out more damaged and more hurt.
How much of this seems to be a funding issue?
We're still reporting on this, and this is one of the parts of it that we're continuing to work on here at the Tribune. Basically, our first series of stories really dealt with just the fundamental issue of safety, of harm to kids inside these facilities. But these facilities are funded by taxpayers already at well over $200 million per year for those 1,400 wards alone. So you're talking about a lot of money. There's also a lot of money spent on monitoring. Apparently, it's about $30 million a year spent by DCFS to monitor these facilities. So we're not sure whether it's a matter of putting more dollars into the system or restructuring the system so that the dollars are better spent. And I think it's an issue that's still at the forefront of our ongoing reporting. It's also something that is going to be taken up by state lawmakers who plan to hold hearings in January on the Tribune series and are specifically going to look at how are these places funded, where's the money going? If we're spending $200 million a year on these facilities, where's the money going? If we're spending $30 million a year on monitoring, how does that system work? And so those are still ongoing reporting issues for us.
And then one other aspect that you were able to touch on was discipline of these teens.
One of the things that really surprised us as we looked through police reports on these facilities is that at some facilities, police are called in almost constantly, and they seem to be used almost as a kind of a de facto behavior management tool. When the staff are overwhelmed and outmanned and exhausted and kids are harming themselves or others, the police are called in. First of all, that raises questions about the way these facilities are being managed. But even more than that, we found that the result of that is that many of these kids come into the facilities without having criminal records, but they pick up criminal records because once the police are in there, they do charge crimes if there's a battery or an assault or something like that. So we found when we really looked in detail at the police records, some of the criminal records the kids were picking up were to us quite shocking. We found kids in Illinois, but also across the country at residential treatment centers who were being charged with crimes for behavior that you would think would be very predictable given their histories of trauma and their mental health and behavioral problems that result from being abused in their past. So we found kids who were charged with crimes for throwing food, for spitting, for resisting the restraint holds that are sometimes used in these facilities. Up in Wisconsin, we looked at one facility where 16 kids had been charged with disorderly conduct for their behavior inside these facilities, including one young man who had gone on a brief run, had run away briefly from the facility, come back and found that the doors were locked, and so he broke a window to get back inside. He was just basically trying to get back into the only home he had, and he was detained by police and charged with disorderly conduct. So we found a lot of that where a kid has a behavior problem or a mental health problem that's quite predictable given the really horrible backgrounds that some of these kids have. They've been abused and neglected, and they go to these places for treatment and instead pick up criminal records.
And so as you mentioned, you're still working on more investigating and reporting, and it seems that this series has already led to some action. Two centers were placed on intake hold, and as you mentioned, the legislature will be holding hearings. What else are you hoping to parse out of this topic that readers can stay tuned for?
First of all, this series has had a real sort of immediate impact. There have actually now been four centers placed on intake hold, and one of them has increased monitoring. There is going to be a standing panel in the General Assembly that's going to look at this issue. It is not only going to look at safety of kids inside these centers, but also look at more broadly the way that Illinois provides mental health services to disadvantaged kids. The governor, outgoing Governor Quinn, and incoming Governor Rauner have both really indicated strong support for that. Rauner has indicated that he really wants to take a sort of a top-to-bottom transformational look at this system. And then as journalists, I can just say that we are still very, very much, we're getting a lot of tips. We're getting a lot of calls coming in. We're getting a lot of ideas. And I can't really talk about those things until they're published. But my colleagues, Gary Marks and Dua Eldeeb and I, who are the core team working on this, have gathered additional information since our first burst of stories were published, and we're continuing to work on things.